And now he's talking about the magic juice. He's being careful, but I swear that's what he's talking about. It's got to be. You're a mind reader, Jack said in a low voice. Aren't you? Did you learn it in the territory, Speedy?
Don't know nothing about reading minds, the blind man said. But my lamps have been out 42 years come November, and in 42 years your nose and ears take up some of the slack. I can smell cheap wine on you, son. Smell it all over you. It's almost like you washed your hair with it.
Jack felt an odd, dreamy guilt. It was the way he always felt when accused of doing something wrong when he was in fact innocent. Mostly innocent, anyway. He had done no more than touch the almost empty bottle since flipping back into this world. Just touching it filled him with dread. He had come to feel about it the way a 14th-century European peasant might have felt about a splinter of the one true cross or the finger bone of a saint. It was magic, all right, powerful magic, and sometimes it got people killed. "I haven't been drinking it, honest," he finally managed. "What I started with is almost gone. I don't even like it." His stomach had begun to clench nervously. Just thinking about the magic juice was making him feel nauseated. "But I need to get some more, just in case."
"More purple Jesus? Boy your age?"
The blind man laughed and made a shooing gesture with one hand.
"Hell, you don't need that. No boy needs that poison to travel with."
"But
here, I'll sing you a song to cheer you up. Sounds like you could use it."
He began to sing, and his singing voice was nothing at all like his speaking voice. It was deep and powerful and thrilling, without the nigger Jim, "My hook that show is gay," cadences of his talk. It was, Jack thought, odd, almost the trained, cultured voice of an opera singer, now amusing itself with a little piece of popular fluff. Jack felt goosebumps rise on his arms and back at that rich, full voice. Along the sidewalk which ran along the dull ochre flank of the mall, heads turned. When the red, red robin goes bob, bob, bobbin' along, along, there'll be no more sobbin' when he starts throbbin' his old sweet song. Jack was struck by a sweet and terrible familiarity, a sense that he had heard this before, or something very like it, and as the blind man bridged, grinning his crooked, yellowing smile, Jack realized where the feeling was coming from. He knew what had made all those heads turn, as they would have turned if a unicorn had gone galloping across the mall's parking lot. There was a beautiful, alien clarity in the man's voice. It was the clarity of, say, air so pure that you could smell a radish when a man pulled one out of the ground half a mile away. It was a good old Tin Pan Alley song, but the voice was pure territories. "Get up, get up, you sleepyhead, get out, get out, get out of bed, live, love, laugh, and be happy." Both guitar and voice came to a sudden halt. Jack, who had been concentrating fiercely on the blind man's face, trying subconsciously to peer right through those dark glasses, perhaps, and see if Speedy Parker's eyes were behind them, now widened his focus and saw two cops standing beside the blind man.
"You know, I don't hear nothing," the blind guitarist said, almost coyly. "But I believe I smell something blue."
"God damn it, Snowball, you know you're not supposed to work the mall," one of the cops cried. "What did Judge Hallis tell you the last time he had you in chambers? Downtown, between Center Street and Mural Street. No place else. Damn, boy, how senile have you got? Your pecker rotted off yet from that what-all your woman gave you before she took off? Christ, I just don't—"
His partner put a hand on his arm and nodded toward Jack in a little pitchers-have-big-ears gesture.
"Go tell your mother she wants you, kid," the first cop said curtly.
Jack started walking down the sidewalk. He couldn't stay. Even if there was something he could do, he couldn't stay. He was lucky the cop's attention had been taken up by the man they called Snowball. If they'd given him a second chance, Jack had no doubt he would have been asked to produce his bona fides. New sneakers or not, the rest of him looked used and battered. It doesn't take cops long to get good at spotting road kids, and Jack was a boy on the road if there ever had been one. He imagined being tossed into the Zanesville pokey while the Zanesville cops, fine upstanding boys in blue who listened to Paul Harvey every day and supported President Reagan, tried to find out whose little boy he was. No, he didn't want the Zanesville cops giving him more than the one passing glance. A motor throbbing smoothly coming up behind him. Jack hunched his pack a little higher on his back and looked down at his new sneakers as if they interested him tremendously. From the corners of his eyes, he saw the police cruiser slide slowly by. The blind man was in the back seat, the neck of his guitar poking up beside him. As the cruiser swung into one of the outbound lanes, the blind man abruptly turned his head and looked out the back window, looked directly at Jack. And although Jack could not see through the dirty, dark glasses, he knew perfectly well that Lester Speedy Parker had winked at him. Jack managed to keep further thought at bay until he reached the turnpike ramps again. He stood looking at the signs, which seemed the only clear-cut things left in a world—worlds, where all else was a maddening gray swirl. He felt a dark depression swirling all around him, sinking into him, trying to destroy his resolve. He recognized that homesickness played a part in this depression, but this feeling made his former homesickness seem boyish and callow indeed. He felt utterly adrift, without a single firm thing to hold on to. Standing by the signs, watching the traffic on the turnpike, Jack realized he felt damn near suicidal. For quite a while he had been able to keep himself going with the thought that he would see Richard Sloat soon, and although he had hardly admitted the thought to himself, the idea that Richard might head west with him had done more than cross Jack's mind. After all, it would not be the first time that a Sawyer and a Sloat had made strange journeys together, would it? But the hard work at the Palo Mountain farm and the peculiar happenings at the Buckeye Mall had given even that the false glitter of fool's gold. "Go home, Jackie. You're beaten," a voice whispered. "If you keep on, you're going to end up getting the living shit kicked out of you. And next time it may be 50 people that die, or 500. I-70 East, I-70 West. Abruptly, he fished in his pocket for the coin, a coin that was a silver dollar in this world. Let whatever gods there were decide this once and for all. He was too beaten to do it himself, his back still smarted where Mr. All-America had whacked him. Come up tails, and he would go down the eastbound ramp and head home. Come up heads, he would go on, and there would be no more looking back. He stood in the dust of the soft shoulder and flicked the coin into the chilly October air. It rose, turning over and over, kicking up glints of sun. Jack craned his head to follow its course. A family, passing in an old station wagon, stopped squabbling long enough to look at him curiously. The man driving the wagon, a balding CPA, who sometimes awoke in the middle of the night fancying that he could feel shooting pains in his chest and down his left arm, had a sudden and absurd series of thoughts. Adventure, danger, a quest of some noble purpose, dreams of fear and glory. He shook his head as if to clear it, and glanced at the boy in the wagon's rear-view mirror just as the kid leaned over to look at something. "Christ," the balding CPA thought. "Get it out of your head, Larry. You sound like a fucking boy's adventure book." Larry shot into traffic, quickly getting the wagon up to 70, forgetting about the kid and the dirty jeans by the side of the road. If he could get home by 3, he'd be in good time to watch the middleweight title fight on ESPN. The coin came down. Jack bent over it. It was heads. But that was not all. The lady on the coin wasn't Lady Liberty. It was Laura DeLoessian, Queen of the Territories. But God, what a difference here from the pale, still, sleeping face he had glimpsed for a moment in the pavilion, surrounded by anxious nurses in their billowing white wimples. This face was alert and aware, eager and beautiful. It was not a classic beauty, the line of the jaw was not clear enough for that, and the cheekbone which showed in profile was a little soft. Her beauty was in the regal set of her head, combined with the clear sense that she was kind as well as capable. And oh, it was so like the face of his mother. Jack's eyes blurred with tears, and he blinked them hard, not wanting the tears to fall. He had cried enough for one day. He had his answer, and it was not for crying over. When he opened his eyes again, Laura DeLuessian was gone. The woman on the coin was Lady Liberty again. He had his answer all the same. Jack bent over, picked up the coin out of the dust, put it in his pocket, and headed down the westbound ramp of Interstate 70. A day later, white overcast in the air that tasted of chilly rain on its way. The Ohio-Indiana border not much more than a lick and a promise from here. Here was in a scrub of woods beyond the Lewisburg rest area on I-70. Jack was standing, concealed, he hoped, among the trees, patiently waiting for the large, bald man with the large, bald voice to get back into his Chevy Nova and drive away. Jack hoped he would go soon before it started to rain. He was cold enough without getting wet, and all morning his sinuses had been plugged, his voice foggy. He thought he must finally be getting a cold. The large, bald man with the large, bald voice had given his name as Emery W. Light. He had picked Jack up around 11 o'clock north of Dayton, and Jack had felt a tired, sinking sensation in the pit of his belly almost at once. He had gotten rides with Emery W. Light before. In Vermont, Light had called himself Tom Ferguson and said he was a shoe shop foreman. In Pennsylvania, the alias had been Bob Darrant, almost like that fellow who sang Splish Splash, ah-ha-ha-ha, and the job had changed to district high school superintendent. This time, Light said he was president of the First Mercantile Bank of Paradise Falls in the town of Paradise Falls, Ohio. Ferguson had been lean and dark, Darrant was portly and pink as a freshly tubbed baby, and this Emery W. Light was large and owlish, with eyes like boiled eggs behind his rimless glasses. Yet all of these differences were only superficial, Jack had found. They all listened to the story with the same breathless interest. They all asked him if he had had any girlfriends back home. Sooner or later he would find a hand, a large, bald hand, lying on his thigh, and when he looked at Ferguson slash Darrant slash Light, he would see an expression of half-mad hope in the eyes mixed with half-mad guilt, and a stipple of sweat on the upper lip. In the case of Darrant, the sweat had gleamed through a dark mustache like tiny white eyes peering through scant underbrush. Ferguson had asked him if he would like to make $10. Darrant had upped that to 20. Light, in a large, bald voice that nonetheless cracked and quivered through several registers, asked him if he couldn't use $50. He always kept a 50 in the heel of his left shoe, he said, and he'd just love to give it to Master Louis Farron. There was a place they could go near Randolph, an empty barn. Jack did not make any correlation between the steadily increasing monetary offers from Light in his various incarnations and any changes his adventures might be working on him. He was not introspective by nature, and had little interest in self-analysis. He had learned quickly enough how to deal with fellows like Emery W. Light. His first experience with Light, when Light had been calling himself Tom Ferguson, had taught him that discretion was by far the better part of valor. When Ferguson put his hand on Jack's thigh, Jack had responded automatically out of a California sensibility in which gaze had been merely part of the scenery. "No, thanks, mister. I'm strictly A.C. He had been groped before, certainly, in movie theaters mostly, but there had been the men's shop clerk in North Hollywood who had cheerfully offered to blow him in a changing booth, and when Jack told him no thanks, the clerk said, "Fine. Now try on the blue blazer, okay?" These were annoyances a good-looking 12-year-old boy in Los Angeles simply learned to put up with, the way a pretty woman learns to put up with being groped occasionally on the subway. You eventually find a way to cope without letting it spoil your whole day. The deliberate passes, such as the one this Ferguson was making, were less of a problem than the sudden gropes from ambush. They could simply be shunted aside. At least in California they could. Eastern gays, especially out here in the sticks, apparently had a different way of dealing with rejection. Ferguson had come to a screeching, sliding halt, leaving 40 yards of rubber behind his Pontiac and throwing a cloud of shoulder dust into the air.
Who you calling D.C.? He screamed. Who you calling queer? I'm not queer. Jesus, give a kid a fucking ride and he calls you a fucking queer.
Jack was looking at him, dazed. Unprepared for the sudden stop, he had thumped his head a damn good one on the padded dash. Ferguson, who had only a moment before been looking at him with melting brown eyes, now looked ready to kill him.
"Get out!" Ferguson yelled. "You're the queer, not me. You're the queer. Get out, you little queer boy. Get out! I've got a wife. I've got kids. I've probably got bastards scattered all over New England. I'm not queer. You're the queer, not me, so get out of my car!"
More terrified than he had been since his encounter with Osman, Jack had done just that. Ferguson tore out, spraying him with gravel, still raving. Jack staggered over to a rock wall, sat down, and began to giggle. The giggles became shrieks of laughter, and he decided right then and there that he would have to develop a policy, at least until he got out of the boondocks. "Any serious problem demands a policy," his father had said once. Morgan had agreed vigorously, but Jack decided he shouldn't let that hold him back. His policy had worked well enough with Bob Darrant, and he had no reason to believe it wouldn't also work with Emery Light. But in the meantime, he was cold and his nose was running. He wished Light would head him up and move him out. Standing in the trees, Jack could see him down there, walking back and forth with his hands in his pockets, his large, bald head gleaming mellowly under the white-out sky. On the turnpike, big semis droned by, filling the air with the stink of burned diesel fuel. The woods here were trashed out the way the woods bordering any interstate rest area always were. Empty Dorito bags, squashed Big Mac boxes, crimped Pepsi and Budweiser cans with pop-tops that rattled inside if you kicked them, smashed bottles of Wild Irish Rose and 5 o'clock gin. A pair of shredded nylon panties over there, with a moldering sanitary napkin still glued to the crotch. A rubber poked over a broken branch. Plenty of nifty stuff, all right. Hey, hey. And lots of graffiti jotted on the walls of the men's room. Almost all of it the sort of fellow like Emery W. Light could really relate to. "I like to suck big fat cocks. Be here at 4 for the best blowjob you ever had. Ream out my butt." And here was a gay poet with large aspirations. "Let the whole human race jerk off on my smiling face." I'm homesick for the territories, Jack thought, and there was no surprise at all in the realization. Here he stood behind 2 brick outhouses off I-70 somewhere in western Ohio, shivering in a ragged sweater he had bought in a thrift store for $1.50, waiting for that large bald man down there to get back on his horse and ride. Jack's policy was simplicity itself. Don't antagonize a man with large bald hands and a large bald voice. Jack sighed with relief. Now it was starting to work. An expression that was half anger, half disgust, had settled over Emery W. Light's large bald face. He went back to his car, got in, backed up so fast he almost hit the pickup truck passing behind him. There was a brief blare of horns, and the passenger in the truck shot Emery W. Light the finger, and then left. Now it was only a matter of standing on the ramp where the rest area traffic rejoined the turnpike traffic with his thumb out, and he hoped catching a ride before it started to rain. Jack spared another look around. Ugly. Wretched. These words came quite naturally to mind as he looked around at the littery desolation here on the rest area's pimply backside. It occurred to Jack that there was a feeling of death here, not just at this rest area or on the interstate roads, but pressed deep into all the country he had traveled. Jack thought that sometimes he could even see it, a desperate shade of hot, dark brown, like the exhaust from the short stack of a fast-moving Jimmy Pete. The new homesickness came back, the wanting to go to the territories and see that dark blue sky, the slight curve at the edge of the horizon. But it plays those Jerry Bledsoe changes. "Don't know nothing about that. All I know is you seem to have this idea of miter a little broad." Walking down to the rest area, now he really did have to urinate, Jack sneezed 3 times quickly. He swallowed and winced at the hot prickle in his throat. Getting sick, oh yeah, great. Not even into Indiana yet. 50 degrees, rain in the forecast, no ride, and now I'm... The thought broke off cleanly. He stared at the parking lot, his mouth falling wide open. For one awful moment he thought he was going to wet his pants, as everything below his breastbone seemed to cramp and squeeze. Sitting in one of the 20 or so slant parking spaces, its deep green surface now dulled with road dirt, was Uncle Morgan's BMW. No chance of a mistake, no chance at all. California vanity plates MLS, standing for Morgan Luther Sloat. It looked as if it had been driven fast and hard. "But if he flew to New Hampshire, how can his car be here?" Jack's mind yammered. "It's a coincidence, Jack. Just a..." Then he saw the man standing with his back to him at the pay telephone and knew it was no coincidence. He was wearing a bulky, army-style anorak, fur-lined, a garment more suited to 5 below than to 50 degrees. Back to or not, there was no mistaking those broad shoulders and that big, loose, hulking frame. The man at the phone started to turn around, crooking the phone between his ear and shoulder. Jack drew back against the brick side of the men's toilet. "Did he see me?" "No," he answered himself. "No, I don't think so. But Captain Farron had said that Morgan, that other Morgan, would smell him like a cat smells a rat. And so he had. From his hiding place in that dangerous forest, Jack had seen the hideous white face in the window of the diligence change. This Morgan would smell him, too, if given the time. Footfalls around the corner, approaching. Face numb and twisted with fear, Jack fumbled off his pack and then dropped it, knowing he was too late, too slow, that Morgan would come around the corner and seize him by the neck, smiling. "Hi, Jackie. Ollie, ollie, in free. Game's over now, isn't it, you little prick?" A tall man in a houndstooth check jacket passed the corner of the restroom, gave Jack a disinterested glance, and went to the drinking fountain. Going back. He was going back. There was no guilt, at least not now, only that terrible, trapped fear mingling oddly with feelings of relief and pleasure. Jack fumbled his pack open. Here was Speedy's bottle, with less than an inch of the purple liquid now left. "No boy needs that poison to travel with, but I do, Speedy, I do," sloshing around in the bottom. No matter, he was going back. His heart leaped at the thought. A big Saturday night grin dawned on his face, denying both the gray day and the fear in his heart. Going back, oh yeah, dig it. More footsteps approaching, and this was Uncle Morgan. No doubt about that heavy yet somehow mincing step. But the fear was gone. Uncle Morgan had smelled something, but when he turned the corner he would see nothing but empty Dorito bags and crimped beer cans. Jack pulled in breath, pulled in the greasy stink of diesel fumes and car exhausts and cold autumn air, tipped the bottle up to his lips, took one of the two swallows left, and even with his eyes shut, he squinted as... Chapter 16 Wolf. The strong sunlight struck his closed lids. Through the gagging, sweet odor of the magic juice, he could smell something else, the warm smell of animals. He could hear them, too, moving all about him. Frightened, Jack opened his eyes, but at first could see nothing. The difference in the light was so sudden and abrupt that it was as if someone had suddenly turned on a cluster of 200-watt bulbs in a black room. A warm, hide-covered flank brushed him, not in a threatening way, or so Jack hoped, but most definitely in an I'm-in-a-hurry-to-be-gone-thank-you-very-much way. Jack, who had been getting up, thumped back to the ground again.
"Hey, hey, get away from him, right here and right now!"
A loud, healthy whack, followed by a disgruntled animal sound, somewhere between a moo and a baa.
"God's nails, got no sense. Get away from him, before I bite your god-pounding eyes out."
Now his eyes had adjusted enough to the brightness of this almost flawless territory's autumn day to make out a young giant standing in the middle of a herd of milling animals, whacking their sides and slightly humped backs with what appeared to be great gusto and very little real force. Jack sat up, automatically finding Speedy's bottle with its one precious swallow left, and putting it away. He never took his eyes from the young man who stood with his back to him. Tall he was, 6'5" at least, Jack guessed, and with shoulders so broad that his across still looked slightly out of proportion to his high. Long, greasy black hair shagged down his back to his shoulder blades. Muscles bulged and rippled as he moved amid the animals, which looked like pygmy cows. He was driving them away from Jack and toward the western road. He was a striking figure, even when seen from behind. But what amazed Jack was his dress. Everyone he had seen in the territories, including himself, had been wearing tunics, jerkins, or rough breeches. This fellow appeared to be wearing Oshkosh bib overalls. Then he turned around, and Jack felt a horrible, shocked dismay well up in his throat. He shot to his feet. It was the Elroy thing. The herdsman was the Elroy thing. Except it wasn't. Jack perhaps would not have lingered to see that, and everything that happened thereafter, the movie theater, the shed, and the Hell of the Sunlight home, would not have happened, or would, at the very least, have happened in some completely different way. But in the extremity of his terror, he froze completely after getting up. He was no more able to run than a deer is when it is frozen in a hunter's jacklight. As the figure in the bib overalls approached, he thought, Elroy wasn't that tall or that broad, and his eyes were yellow. The eyes of this creature were a bright, impossible shade of orange. Looking into them was like looking into the eyes of a Halloween pumpkin. And while Elroy's grin had promised madness and murder, the smile on this fellow's face was large and cheerful and harmless. His feet were bare, huge and spatulate, the toes clumped into groups of three and two, barely visible through curls of wiry hair. Not hoof-like, as Elroy's had been, Jack realized, half-crazed with surprise, fear, a dawning amusement, but pad-like, paw-like. As he closed the distance between himself and Jack, his, its, eyes flared an even brighter orange, going for a moment to the day-glow shade favored by hunters and flagmen on road repair jobs. The color faded to a muddy hazel. As it did, Jack saw that his smile was puzzled as well as friendly, and understood two things at once. First, that there was no harm in this fellow, not an ounce of it. And second, that he was slow. Not feeble, perhaps, but slow. Wolf! The big, hairy boy-beast cried, grinning. His tongue was long and pointed, and Jack thought with a shudder that a wolf was exactly what he looked like. Not a goat, but a wolf. He hoped he was right about there not being any harm in him. But if I made a mistake about that, at least I won't have to worry about making any more mistakes ever again. Wolf! Wolf! He stuck out one hand, and Jack saw that, like his feet, his hands were covered with hair, although this hair was finer and more luxuriant, actually quite handsome. It grew especially thick in the palms, where it was the soft white of a blaze on a horse's forehead. My God, I think he wants to shake hands with me. Gingerly, thinking of Uncle Tommy, who had told him he must never refuse a handshake, not even with his worst enemy, fight him to the death afterward if you must, but shake his hand first, Uncle Tommy had said, Jack put his own hand out, wondering if it was about to be crushed, or perhaps eaten. Wolf! Wolf! Shaking hands right here and now, the boy thing in the Oshkosh bibballs cried, delighted. Right here and now! Good old wolf! God pound it! Right here and now! Wolf! In spite of this enthusiasm, Wolf's grip was gentle enough, cushioned by the crisp, furry growth of hair on his hand. Bib overalls and a big handshake from a guy who looks like an overgrown Siberian husky and smells a little bit like a hayloft after a heavy rain, Jack thought. What next? An offer to come to his church this Sunday? Good old Wolf, you bet! Good old Wolf right here and now! Wolf wrapped his arms around his huge chest and laughed, delighted with himself. Then he grabbed Jack's hand again. This time his hand was pumped vigorously up and down. Something seemed required of him at this point, Jack reflected. Otherwise this pleasant, if rather simple, young man might go on shaking his hand until sundown. "Good old wolf," he said. It seemed to be a phrase of which his new acquaintance was particularly fond. Wolf laughed like a child and dropped Jack's hand. This was something of a relief. The hand had been neither crushed nor eaten, but it did feel a bit seasick. Wolf had a faster pump than a slot machine player on a hot streak.
"Stranger, ain't ya?" Wolf asked.
He stuffed his hairy hands into the slit sides of his bibballs and began playing pocket pool with a complete lack of self-consciousness. "Yes," Jack said, thinking of what that word meant over here. It had a very specific meaning over here. "Yes, I guess that's just what I am, a stranger."
"God pounding right. I can smell it on you, right here and now. Oh, yeah, oh, boy, got it. Doesn't smell bad, you know, but it sure is funny. Wolf, that's me, wolf, wolf, wolf."
He threw back his head and laughed. The sound ended being something that was disconcertingly like a howl. "Jack," Jack said. Jack saw his hand was seized again and pumped with abandon. "Sawyer," he finished when he was released again. He smiled, feeling very much as though someone had hit him with a great big goofy stick. 5 minutes ago, he had been standing scrunched against the cold brick side of a shithouse on I-70. Now he was standing here talking to a young fellow who seemed to be more animal than man. And damned if his cold wasn't completely gone.
"Wolf meet Jack. Jack meet Wolf. Here and now. Okay, good. Old Jason, cows in the road, ain't they stupid? Wolf, Wolf."
Yelling, Wolf loped down the hill to the road, where about half of his herd was standing, looking around with expressions of bland surprise, as if to ask where the grass had gone. They really did look like some strange cross between cows and sheep, Jack saw, and wondered what you would call such a crossbreed. The only word to come immediately to mind was creeps, or perhaps he thought the singular would be more proper in this case, as in, here's Wolf taking care of his flock of creep. Oh yeah, right here and now. The goofy stick came down on Jack's head again. He sat down and began to giggle, his hands crisscrossed over his mouth to stifle the sounds. Even the biggest creep stood no more than 4 feet high. Their fur was woolly, but of a muddy shade that was similar to Wolf's eyes, at least when Wolf's eyes weren't blazing like Halloween jack-o'-lanterns. Their heads were topped with short, squiggly horns that looked good for absolutely nothing. Wolf herded them back out of the road. They went obediently with no sign of fear. If a cow or a sheep on my side of the jump got a whiff of that guy, Jack thought, it'd kill itself trying to get out of his way. But Jack liked Wolf, liked him on sight, just as he had feared and disliked Elroy on sight. And that contrast was particularly apt, because the comparison between the two was undeniable. Except that Elroy had been goatish, while Wolf was, well, wolfish. Jack walked slowly toward where Wolf had set his herd to graze. He remembered tiptoeing down the stinking back hall of the Oatley Tap toward the fire door, sensing Elroy somewhere near, smelling him, perhaps, as a cow on the other side would undoubtedly smell Wolf. He remembered the way Elroy's hands had begun to twist and thicken, the way his neck had swelled, the way his teeth had become a mouthful of blackening fangs. "Wolf?" Wolf turned and looked at him, smiling. His eyes flared a bright orange, and looked for a moment both savage and intelligent. Then the glow faded, and they were only that muddy, perpetually puzzled hazel again. "Are you sort of a werewolf?"
"Sure am," Wolf said, smiling. "You pounded that nail, Jack. Wolf."
Jack sat down on a rock, looking at Wolf thoughtfully. He believed it would be impossible for him to be further surprised than he had already been, but Wolf managed the trick quite nicely. "How's your father, Jack?" he asked in that casual, by-the-way tone reserved for inquiring after the relatives of others. "How's Phil doing these days?"
"Wolf?"
Jack made a queerly apt cross-association. He felt as if all the wind had been knocked out of his mind. For a moment it just sat there in his head, not a thought in it, like a radio station broadcasting nothing but a carrier wave. Then he saw Wolf's face change. The expression of happiness and childish curiosity was replaced by one of sorrow. Jack saw that Wolf's nostrils were flaring rapidly.
"He's dead, isn't he? Wolf? I'm sorry, Jack. God pound me, I'm stupid, stupid!"
Wolf crashed a hand into his forehead, and this time he really did howl. It was a sound that chilled Jack's blood. The herd of creep looked around uneasily.
"That's all right," Jack said.
He heard his voice more in his ears than in his head, as if someone else had spoken.
"But how did you know?"
"Your smell changed," Wolf said simply. "I knew he was dead because it was in your smell. Poor Phil, what a good guy. Tell you that right here and now, Jack. Your father was a good guy, Wolf."
"Yes," Jack said, "he was. But how did you know him? And how did you know he was my father?"
Wolf looked at Jack as though he had asked a question so simple it barely needed answering.
"I remember his smell, of course. Wolves remember all smells. You smell just like him."
Whack! The goofy stick came down on his head again. Jack felt an urge to just roll back and forth on the tough, springy turf, holding his gut and howling. People had told him he had his father's eyes and his father's mouth, even his father's knack for quick sketching. But never before had he been told that he smelled like his father. Yet he supposed the idea had a certain crazy logic at that.
"How did you know him?" Jack asked again.
Wolf looked at a loss.
"He came with the other one," he said at last. "The one from Oris. I was just little. The other one was bad. The other one stole some of us. Your father didn't know," he added hastily, as if Jack had shown anger. "Wolf? No, he was good, your father. Phil, the other one..."
Wolf shook his head slowly. On his face was an expression even more simple than his pleasure. It was the memory of some childhood nightmare.
"Bad," Wolf said. "He made himself a place in this world, my father says. Mostly he was in his twinner, but he was from your world. We knew he was bad, we could tell. But who listens to wolves? No one. Your father knew he was bad, but he couldn't smell him as good as we could. He knew he was bad, but not how bad."
And Wolf threw his head back and howled again, a long, chilly ululation of sorrow that resounded against the deep blue sky. Interlude. Sloat in This World, 2. From the pocket of his bulky parka, he had bought it convinced that from the Rockies East, America was a frigid wasteland after October 1st or so. Now he was sweating rivers. Morgan Sloat took a small steel box. Below the latch were 10 small buttons and an oblong of cloudy yellow glass, 1/4 inch high and 2 inches long. He pushed several of the buttons carefully with the fingernail of his left-hand pinky, and a series of numbers appeared briefly in the readout window. Sloat had bought this gadget, billed as the world's smallest safe, in Zurich. According to the man who had sold it to him, not even a week in a crematory oven would breach its carbon steel integrity. Now it clicked open. Sloat folded back 2 tiny wings of ebony jeweler's velvet, revealing something he had had for well over 20 years, since long before the odious little brat who was causing all this trouble had been born. It was a tarnished tin key, and once it had gone into the back of a mechanical toy soldier. Sloat had seen the toy soldier in the window of a junk shop in the odd little town of Point Venuti, California, a town in which he had great interest. Acting under a compulsion much too strong to deny, he hadn't even wanted to deny it, not really, he had always made a virtue of compulsion, had Morgan Sloat, he had gone in and paid $5 for the dusty, dented soldier. And it wasn't the soldier he had wanted anyway. It was the key that had caught his eye and then whispered to him. He had removed the key from the soldier's back and pocketed it as soon as he was outside the junk shop door. The soldier itself he threw in a litter basket outside the Dangerous Planet bookstore. Now, as Sloat stood beside his car in the Lewisburg rest area, he held the key up and looked at it. Like Jack's croaker, the tin key became something else in the territories. Once, when coming back, he had dropped that key in the lobby of the old office building. and there must have been some territory's magic left in it, because that idiot Jerry Bledsoe had gotten himself fried not an hour later. Had Jerry picked it up? Stepped on it, perhaps? Sloat didn't know, and didn't care. Nor had he cared a tinker's damn about Jerry. And considering the handyman had had an insurance policy specifying double indemnity for accidental death, the building super with whom Sloat sometimes shared a hash pipe had passed this little tidbit on to him, Sloat imagined that Nita Bledsoe had done nip-ups. But he had been nearly frantic about the loss of his key. It was Phil Sawyer who had found it, giving it back to him with no comment other than, "Here, Morg, your lucky charm, isn't it? Must have a hole in your pocket. I found it in the lobby after they took poor old Jerry away." Yes, in the lobby. In the lobby where everything smelled like the motor of a wearing blender that had been running continuously on high speed for about 9 hours. In the lobby where everything had been blackened and twisted and fused. Except for this humble tin key, which in the other world was a queer kind of lightning rod, and which Sloat now hung around his neck on a fine silver chain. "Coming for you, Jackie," said Sloat, in a voice that was almost tender. "Time to bring this entire ridiculous business to a crashing halt." Chapter 17 Wolf and the Herd. Wolf talked of many things, getting up occasionally to shoo his cattle out of the road, and once to move them to a stream about half a mile to the west. When Jack asked him where he lived, Wolf only waved his arm vaguely northward. He lived, he said, with his family. When Jack asked for clarification a few minutes later, Wolf looked surprised and said he had no mate and no children, that he would not come into what he called the Big Rut Moon for another year or two. That he looked forward to the Big Rut Moon was quite obvious from the innocently lewd grin that overspread his face. "But you said you lived with your family."
"Oh, family, them, Wolf."
Wolf laughed.
"Sure, them. We all live together, have to keep the cattle, you know, her cattle."
"The Queen's?"
"Yes. May she never, never die."
And Wolf made an absurdly touching salute, bending briefly forward with his right hand touching his forehead. Further questioning straightened the matter out somewhat in Jack's mind. At least he thought it did. Wolf was a bachelor, although that word barely fit somehow. The family of which he spoke was a hugely extended one, literally the Wolf family. They were a nomadic but fiercely loyal race that moved back and forth in the great empty areas east of the outposts but west of the settlements, by which Wolf seemed to mean the towns and villages of the east. Wolfs, never wolves, when Jack once used the proper plural, Wolf had laughed until tears spurted from the corners of his eyes, were solid, dependable workers for the most part. Their strength was legendary, their courage unquestioned. Some of them had gone east into the settlements where they served the Queen as guards, soldiers, even as personal bodyguards. Their lives, Wolf explained to Jack, had only two great touchstones, the lady and the family. Most of the Wolfs, he said, served the lady as he did, watching the herds. The cow-sheep were the territory's primary source of meat, cloth, tallow, and lamp oil. Wolf did not tell Jack this, but Jack inferred it from what he said. All the cattle belonged to the Queen, and the Wolf family had been watching over them since time out of mind. It was their job. In this, Jack found an oddly persuasive correlative to the relationship that had existed between the buffalo and the Indians of the American plains, at least until the white man had come into those territories and upset the balance. "Behold, and the lion shall lie down with the lamb, and the wolf with the creep," Jack murmured and smiled. He was lying on his back with his hands laced behind his head. The most marvelous feeling of peace and ease had stolen over him.
"What, Jack?"
"Nothing," he said. "Wolf, do you really change into an animal when the moon gets full?"
"Course I do," Wolf said.
He looked astounded, as if Jack had asked him something like, "Wolf, do you really pull up your pants after you finish taking a crap?"
"Strangers don't, do they? Phil told me that."
"The, herd," Jack said. "When you change,
do they? Oh, we don't go near the herd when we change, Wolf said seriously. Good Jason, no, we'd eat them. Don't you know that? And a wolf who eats of his herd must be put to death. The Book of Good Farming says so. Wolf, wolf. We have places to go when the moon is full. So does the herd. They're stupid, but they know they have to go away at the time of the big moon. Wolf, they better know, God pound 'em.
But you do eat meat, don't you? Jack asked.
Full of questions, just like your father, Wolf said. Wolf? I don't mind. Yeah, we eat meat, of course we do. We're wolves, aren't we?
But if you don't eat from the herds, what do you eat?
We eat well, Wolf said,
and would say no more on that subject. Like everything else in the territories, Wolf was a mystery that was both gorgeous and frightening. The fact that he had known both Jack's father and Morgan Sloat, had at least met their twinners on more than one occasion, contributed to Wolf's particular aura of mystery, but did not define it completely. Everything Wolf told him led Jack to a dozen more questions, most of which Wolf couldn't or wouldn't answer. The matter of Philip Sawtell's and Oris's visits was a case in point. They had first appeared when Wolf was in the Little Moon and living with his mother and two litter sisters. They were apparently just passing through, as Jack himself was now doing, only they had been heading east instead of west.
"Tell you the truth, you're just about the only human I've ever seen this far west who is still going west," Wolf said.
They had been jolly enough company, both of them. It was only later that there had been trouble with Oris. That had been after the partner of Jack's father had made himself a place in this world, Wolf told Jack again and again, only now he seemed to mean Sloat in the physical guise of Oris. Wolf said that Morgan had stolen one of his litter sisters.
My mother bit her hands and toes for a month after she knew for certain that he took her, Wolf told Jack matter-of-factly,
and had taken other wolves from time to time. Wolf dropped his voice and, with an expression of fear and superstitious awe on his face, told Jack that the limping man had taken some of these wolves into the other world, the place of the strangers, and had taught them to eat of the herd. "That's very bad for guys like you, isn't it?" Jack asked.
"They're damned," Wolf replied simply.
Jack had thought at first that Wolf was speaking of kidnapping. The verb Wolf had used in connection with his litter sister, after all, was the territory's version of take. He began to see now that kidnapping wasn't what was going on at all, unless Wolf, with unconscious poetry, had been trying to say that Morgan had kidnapped the minds of some of the Wolf family. Jack now thought that Wolf was really talking about werewolves who had thrown over their ancient allegiance to the crown and the herd and had given it to Morgan instead. Morgan Sloat and Morgan of Oris. Which led, naturally enough, to thoughts of Elroy. A wolf who eats of his herd must be put to death. To thoughts of the men in the green car who had stopped to ask him directions and offered him a Tootsie Roll, and who had then tried to pull him into their car. The eyes had changed. They're damned. He made himself a place in this world. Until now, he had felt both safe and delighted. Delighted to be back in the territories where there was a nip in the air, but nothing like the dull, cold, gray bite of western Ohio, safe with big, friendly Wolf beside him, way out in the country, miles from anything or anyone. Made himself a place in this world. He asked Wolf about his father, Philip Sawtell, in this world, but Wolf only shook his head. He had been a god-pounding good guy, and a twinner, thus obviously a stranger, but that was all Wolf seemed to know. Twinners, he said, was something that had something to do with litters of people, and about such business he could not presume to say. Nor could he describe Philip Sawtell. He didn't remember. He only remembered the smell. All he knew, he told Jack, was that while both of the strangers had seemed nice, only Phil Sawyer had really been nice. Once he had brought presents for Wolf and his litter sisters and litter brothers. One of the presents, unchanged from the world of the strangers, had been a set of bib overalls for Wolf.
"I wore 'em all the time," Wolf said. "My mother wanted to throw 'em away after I'd worn 'em for 5 years or so. Said they were worn out. Said I was too big for 'em, Wolf."
Said they were only patches, holding more patches together. I wouldn't give them up, though. Finally, she bought some cloth from a drummer headed out toward the outposts. I don't know how much she paid, and, Wolf, I'll tell you the truth, Jack, I'm afraid to ask. She dyed it blue and made me 6 pairs. The ones your father brought me, I sleep on them now. Wolf, Wolf, it's my God-pounding pillow, I guess. Wolf smiled so openly and yet so wistfully that Jack was moved to take his hand. It was something he never could have done in his old life, no matter what the circumstances. But that now seemed like his loss. He was glad to take Wolf's warm, strong hand. "I'm glad you liked my dad, Wolf," he said.
I did, Wolf, Wolf."
And then all hell broke loose. Wolf stopped talking and looked around, startled. "Wolf? What's..."
"Shh!"
Then Jack heard it. Wolf's more sensitive ears had picked the sound up first, but it swelled quickly. Before long, a deaf man would have heard it, Jack thought. The cattle looked around and then began to move away from the source of the sound in a rough, uneasy clot. It was like a radio sound effect, where someone is supposed to be ripping a bedsheet down the middle very slowly. Only the volume kept going up and up and up until Jack thought he was going to go crazy. Wolf leaped to his feet, looking stunned and confused and frightened. That ripping sound, a low, ragged purr, continued to grow. The bleating of the cattle became louder. Some were backing into the stream, and as Jack looked that way, he saw one go down with a splash and a clumsy flailing of legs. It had been pushed over by its milling, retreating comrades. It let out a shrill, baaing cry. Another cow-sheep stumbled over it and was likewise trampled into the water by the slow retreat. The far side of the stream was low and wet, green with reeds, muddy, marshy. The cow-sheep who first reached this muck quickly became mired in it.
"Oh, you God-pounding, good-for-nothing cattle!" Wolf bellowed and charged down the hill toward the stream,
where the first animal to fall over now looked as if it were in its death throes.
"Wolf!"
Jack shouted, but Wolf couldn't hear him. Jack could barely hear himself over that ragged, ripping sound. He looked a little to the right on this side of the stream and gaped with amazement. Something was happening to the air. A patch of it, about 3 feet off the ground, was rippling and blistering, seeming to twist and pull at itself. Jack could see the western road through this patch of air, but the road seemed blurry and shimmery, as if seen through the heated, rippling air over an incinerator. "Something's pulling the air open like a wound. Something's coming through. From our side? Oh, Jason, is that what I do when I come through?" But even in his own panic and confusion, he knew it was not. Jack had a good idea who would come through like this, like a rape in progress. Jack began to run down the hill. The ripping sound went on and on and on. Wolf was down on his knees in the stream, trying to help the second downed animal to its feet. The first floated limply downstream, its body tattered and mangled.
"Get up! God pound you, get up, Wolf!"
Wolf shoved and slapped as best he could at the cow-sheep who milled and backed into him, then got both arms around the drowning animal's midriff and pulled upward.
"Wolf, here and now!" he screamed.
The sleeves of his shirt split wide open along the biceps, reminding Jack of David Banner having one of the gamma-ray-inspired tantrums that turned him into the Incredible Hulk. Water sprayed everywhere, and Wolf lurched to his feet, eyes blazing orange, blue overalls now soaked black. Water streamed from the nostrils of the animal, which Wolf held clutched against his chest as if it were an overgrown puppy. Its eyes were turned up to sticky whites.
"Wolf!" Jack screamed. "It's Morgan! It's the herd!" Wolf screamed back. "Wolf! Wolf! My God-pounding herd! Jack, don't try..."
The rest was drowned out by a grinding clap of thunder that shook the earth. For a moment, the thunder even covered that maddening, monotonous ripping sound. Almost as confused as Wolf's cattle, Jack looked up and saw a clear blue sky, innocent of clouds save for a few puffy white ones that were miles away.
The thunder ignited outright panic in Wolf's herd. They tried to bolt, but in their exquisite stupidity, many of them tried to do it by backing up. They crashed and splashed and were rolled underwater. Jack heard the bitter snap of a breaking bone, followed by the baaing scream of an animal in pain. Wolf bellowed in rage, dropped the cow sheep he had been trying to save, and floundered toward the muddy far bank of the stream. Before he could get there, half a dozen cattle struck him and bore him down. Water splashed and flew in thin, bright sprays. Now Jack saw Wolf was the one in danger of being simultaneously trampled and drowned by the stupid fleeing animals. Jack pushed into the stream, which was now dark with roiling mud. The current tried continually to push him off balance. A bleeding cow sheep, its eyes rolling madly, splashed past him, almost knocking him down. Water sprayed into his face, and Jack tried to wipe it out of his eyes. Now that sound seemed to fill the whole world. Rip! Wolf. Never mind Morgan, at least not for the moment. Wolf was in trouble. His shaggy, drenched head was momentarily visible above the water, and then three of the animals ran right over him, and Jack could only see one waving, fur-covered hand. He pushed forward again, trying to weave through the cattle, some still up, others floundering and drowning underfoot. "Jack!" A voice bellowed over that ripping noise. It was a voice Jack knew, Uncle Morgan's voice. "Jack!" There was another clap of thunder, this one a huge oaken thud that rolled through the sky like an artillery shell. Panting, his soaked hair hanging in his eyes, Jack looked over his shoulder and directly into the rest area on I-70 near Lewisburg, Ohio. He was seeing it as if through ripply, badly made glass, but he was seeing it. The edge of the brick toilet was on the left side of that blistered, tortured patch of air. The snout of what looked like a Chevrolet pickup truck was on the right, floating 3 feet above the field where he and Wolf had been sitting peacefully and talking not 5 minutes ago. And in the center, looking like an extra in a film about Admiral Byrd's assault on the South Pole, was Morgan Sloat, his thick red face twisted with murderous rage. Rage and something else. Triumph? Yes, Jack thought that was what it was. He stood at midstream in water that was crotch deep, cattle passing on either side of him, baaing and bleeding, staring at that window which had been torn in the very fabric of reality, his eyes wide, his mouth wider. "He's found me. Oh, dear God, he's found me."
"There you are, you little shithead," Morgan bellowed at him.
His voice carried, but it had a muffled, dead quality as it came from the reality of that world into the reality of this one. It was like listening to a man shout inside a telephone booth,
"Now we'll see, won't we? Won't we?"
Morgan started forward, his face swimming and rippling as if made of limp plastic, and Jack had time to see there was something clutched in his hand, something hung around his neck, something small and silvery. Jack stood, paralyzed, as Sloat bulled his way through the hole between the two universes. As he came, he did his own werewolf number, changing from Morgan Sloat, investor, land speculator, and sometime Hollywood agent, into Morgan of Orris, pretender to the throne of a dying queen. His flushed, hanging jowls thinned, the color faded out of them. His hair renewed itself, growing forward, first tinting the rondeur of his skull, as if some invisible being were coloring Uncle Morgan's head, then covering it. The hair of Sloat's twinner was long, black, flapping, somehow dead-looking. It had been tied at the nape of his neck, Jack saw, but most of it had come loose. The parka wavered, disappeared for a moment, then came back as a cloak and hood. Morgan Sloat's suede boots became dark leather knee boots, their tops turned down, what might have been the hilt of a knife poking out of one. And the small silver thing in his hand had turned to a small rod tipped with crawling blue fire. "It's a lightning rod. Oh, Jesus, it's a jock!" The cry was low, gargling, full of water. Jack whirled clumsily around in the stream, barely avoiding another cow sheep, this one floating on its side, dead in the water. He saw Wolf's head going down again, both hands waving. Jack fought his way toward those hands, still dodging the cattle as best he could. One of them bunted his hip hard, and Jack went over, inhaling water. He got up again quick, coughing and choking, one hand feeling inside his jerkin for the bottle, afraid it might have washed away. It was still there.
"Boy, turn around and look at me, boy."
"No time just now, Morgan. Sorry, but I've got to see if I can avoid getting drowned by Wolf's herd before I see if I can avoid getting fried by your doomstick there." I blew fire, arched over Jack's shoulders, sizzling. It was like a deadly electric rainbow. It struck one of the cow sheep caught in the reedy muck on the other side of the stream, and the unfortunate beast simply exploded, as if it had swallowed dynamite. Blood flew in a needle spray of droplets. Gobbets of flesh began to rain down around Jack.
"Turn and look at me, boy!"
He could feel the force of that command, gripping his face with invisible hands, trying to turn it. Wolf struggled up again, his hair plastered against his face, his dazed eyes peering through a curtain of it like the eyes of an English sheepdog. He was coughing and staggering, seemingly no longer aware of where he was. "Wolf!" Jack screamed, but thunder exploded across the blue sky again, drowning him out. Wolf bent over and retched up a great muddy sheet of water. A moment later, another of the terrified cow sheep struck him and bore him under again. "That's it," Jack thought despairingly. "That's it. He's gone. Must be. Let him go. Get out of here." But he struggled on toward Wolf, pushing a dying, weakly convulsing cow sheep out of his way to get there.
"Jason!" Morgan of Oris screamed,
and Jack realized that Morgan was not cursing in the territory's argo. He was calling his, Jack's, name. Only here he was not Jack. Here he was Jason. But the Queen's son died an infant. Died. He, the wet, sizzling zap of electricity again, seeming almost to part his hair. Again it struck the other bank, this time vaporizing one of Wolf's cattle. No, Jack saw, at least not utterly. The animal's legs were still there, mired in the mud like shake poles. As he watched, they began to sag tiredly outward in four different directions.
"Turn and look at me, God pound you!"
The water. Why doesn't he throw it at the water, fry me, Wolf, all these animals at the same time? Then his fifth-grade science came back to him. Once electricity went to water, it could go anywhere, including back to the generator of the current. Wolf's dazed face, floating underwater, drove these thoughts from Jack's flying mind. Wolf was still alive, but partially pinned under a cow sheep, which, although apparently unhurt, had frozen in panic. Wolf's hands waved with pathetic, flagging energy. As Jack closed the last of the distance, one of those hands dropped and simply floated, limp as a water lily. Without slowing, Jack lowered his left shoulder and hit the cow sheep like Jack Armstrong in a boy's sports story. If it had been a full-sized cow instead of a territory's compact model, Jack would probably not have budged it, not with the stream's fairly stiff current working against him. But it was smaller than a cow, and Jack was pumped up. It bawled when Jack hit it, floundered backward, sat briefly on its haunches, and then lunged for the far bank. Jack grabbed Wolf's hands and pulled with all of his might. Wolf came up, as reluctantly as a waterlogged tree trunk, his eyes now glazed and half-closed, water streaming from his ears and nose and mouth. His lips were blue. Twin forks of lightning blazed to the right and left of where Jack stood holding Wolf, the two of them looking like a pair of drunks trying to waltz in a swimming pool. On the far bank, another cow sheep flew in all directions, its severed head still bawling. Hot rips of fire zigzagged through the marshy area, lighting the reeds on the tussocks and then finding the drier grass of the field where the land began to rise again.
"Wolf!" Jack screamed. "Wolf, for Christ's sake!"
"Ugh!"
Wolf moaned and vomited warm, muddy water over Jack's shoulder.
"Ugh!"
Now Jack saw Morgan standing on the other bank, a tall, puritanical figure in his black cloak. His hood framed his pallid, vampire-like face with a kind of cheerless romance. Jack had time to think that the territories had worked their magic even here, on behalf of his dreadful uncle. Over here, Morgan was not an overweight, hypertensive, actuarial toad with piracy in his heart and murder in his mind. Over here, his face had narrowed and found a frigid, masculine beauty. He pointed the silver rod like a toy magic wand, and blue fire tore the air open.
"Now you and your dumb friend!" Morgan screamed.
His thin lips split in a triumphant grin, revealing sunken yellow teeth that spoiled Jack's blurred impression of beauty once and forever. Wolf screamed and jerked in Jack's aching arms. He was staring at Morgan, his eyes orange and bulging with hate and fear.
"You devil!" Wolf screamed. "You devil! My sister! My litter sister! Wolf! Wolf! You devil!"
Jack pulled the bottle out of his jerkin. There was a single swallow left anyway. He couldn't hold Wolf up with his one arm. He was losing him, and Wolf seemed unable to support himself. Didn't matter, couldn't take him back through into the other world anyway. Or could he?
"You devil!"
Wolf screamed, weeping, his wet face sliding down Jack's arm. The back of his bib overalls floated and belled in the water. Smell of burning grass and burning animals, thunder exploding. This time the river of fire in the air rushed by Jack so close that the hairs in his nostrils singed and curled.
"Oh, yes, both of you," Morgan howled. "I'll teach you to get in my way, you little bastard. I'll burn both of you. I'll pound you down."
"Wolf, hold on," Jack yelled. He gave up his effort to hold Wolf up. Instead, he snatched Wolf's hand in his own and held it as tightly as he could. "Hold on to me, do you hear? Wolf!" He tipped the bottle up, and the awful, cold taste of rotted grapes filled his mouth for the last time. The bottle was empty. As he swallowed, he heard it shatter as one of Morgan's bolts of lightning struck it. But the sound of the breaking glass was faint, the tingle of electricity, even Morgan's screams of rage. He felt as if he were falling over backward into a hole, a grave, maybe. Then Wolf's hand squeezed down on Jack so hard that Jack groaned. That feeling of vertigo, of having done a complete dipsy-doodle, began to fade. And then the sunlight faded, too, and became the sad, purplish-gray of an October twilight in the heartland of America. Cold rain struck Jack in the face, and he was faintly aware that the water he was standing in seemed much colder than it had only seconds ago. Somewhere not far away, he could hear the familiar snoring drone of the big rigs on the interstate, except that now they seemed to be coming from directly overhead. Impossible, he thought. But was it? The bounds of that word seemed to be stretching with plastic ease. For one dizzy moment, he had an image of Flying Territories trucks driven by Flying Territories men with big canvas wings strapped to their backs. Back, he thought. Back again. Same time, same turnpike. He sneezed. Same cold, too. But two things were not the same now. No rest area here. They were standing thigh-deep in the icy water of a stream beneath a turnpike overpass. Wolf was with him. That was the other change. And Wolf was screaming. Chapter 18. Wolf Goes to the Movies. Overhead, another truck pounded across the overpass, big diesel engine bellowing. The overpass shook. Wolf wailed and clutched at Jack, almost knocking them both into the water. "Quit it!" Jack shouted. "Let go of me, Wolf! It's just a truck! Let go!" He slapped at Wolf, not wanting to do it. Wolf's terror was pathetic. But pathetic or not, Wolf had the best part of a foot and maybe 150 pounds on Jack, and if he overbore him, they would both go into this freezing water, and it would be pneumonia for sure.
"Wolf, don't like it! Wolf, don't like it! Wolf, Wolf!"
But his hold slackened. A moment later, his arms dropped to his sides. When another truck snored by overhead, Wolf cringed, but managed to keep from grabbing Jack again.
But he looked at Jack with a mute, trembling appeal that said, "Get me out of this, please, get me out of this. I'd rather be dead than in this world." "Nothing I'd like better, Wolf, but Morgan's over there, even if he weren't. I don't have the magic juice anymore." He looked down at his left hand and saw he was holding the jagged neck of Speedy's bottle, like a man getting ready to do some serious barroom brawling. Just dumb luck Wolf hadn't gotten a bad cut when he grabbed Jack in his terror. Jack tossed it away, splash. Two trucks this time, the noise was doubled. Wolf howled in terror and plastered his